Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Oh, and we are. Hey, everyone. It's Molly Wood. It never gets old to us. Welcome to Make Me Smart. It is the Tuesday show where none of us is as smart as all of us. We should just start calling this the show where we bring in some help.
That's right, because help we need. So here's the deal. This is the Tuesday show, which is the granddaddy show, right? It's the one we originally started doing. And we originally started doing it 4 years ago today, which kind of to me sounds terrifying and amazing all at the same time.
I know. 4 years. It was so fast and yet so slow. It was right. We started, you know, right after the inauguration of Donald Trump. It wasn't necessarily our plan because the podcast had been in the works for a while. But then we thought, boy, this is useful timing for a show where we try to stay calm. We have not always succeeded, I think it's fair to say, over the 4 years, but we've been through a lot together.
We have not, and we should just acknowledge that the other thing we're going through together right now is a jackhammer in your backyard.
We should, okay. Yes. I'm so sorry. I really wanted to stop them, but the thing is, it's going to rain any minute, and we just have to get as much done as we can.
Fair enough. So let's get to it. We are going to talk today about institutions and this democracy and capitalism and where things stand after 4 years of the Trump administration going into who knows what in the Biden administration, honestly.
Yeah, seriously. So to do this, because we believe that in order to rebuild the economy, we have to make sure we have a healthy democracy with strong institutions, we wanted to talk to someone who knows a lot about this dynamic. MIT economist and author of the book Why Nations Fail, Doron Acemoglu, is here to make us smart. Welcome.
Thank you, Molly. Thank you, Kai. It's great to be here with you.
So I guess we should start with a little status check, right? When you look at not only the last 4 years, but one could argue just the last 4 weeks up to and including this attack on the Capitol, how would you rate the condition of U.S. democracy?
Well, the last 4 weeks do look a little bit like a banana republic, but I think that's the wrong perspective just to focus on the last 4 weeks. I don't think what we have experienced over the last 4 weeks is surprising in some sense, given what has gone on over the last 4 years. There has been a constant weakening of U.S. institutions, and we have seen every level of government fail at keeping the Trump administration accountable. The only thing that saved us, in some sense, is civil society, media, and voters, that are the three objects that are outside of the government that have, to some degree, resisted Trump's machinations and have managed to first swing the Congress control from the House's control from Republicans and then finally kick him out of power. But I also think that it is wrong to think of the, to sort of get excited about the euphoria of the last few days and think, okay, we've turned a corner, everything is going to be great. Sure, things would have been really terrible. So we are really fortunate that Trump administration is out. But the task of rebuilding U.S. institutions is far from trivial. The way that I see it is that the deep problem, economic and cultural, that brought Trump to power are still there. And I fear Trump will not be the last American populist. And the next one may be smarter and more damaging.
So you have written in the past number of weeks, Professor, about how we ought not be sitting back and saying, phew, the institutions held because we put off the insurrection and democracy, as President Biden said in his inaugural, prevailed. But I guess the thing I want to ask you as a student and an observer of democracy in this economy is how essential are those institutions, weakened as they may be, to the success of the American economy?
Oh, they are critical. You know, my own research is very much about the effects of various institutional arrangements, both economic and political, on economic growth. And nothing in social science is perfect, but it is difficult to see how you can sort of overturn the general proposition that good economic institutions, good political institutions lead to better economic outcomes. There are exceptions, but generally for an economy like the US especially, that thrives on new technology, innovation, entrepreneurship, of course these institutions are critical. If kleptocracy, cronyism, repression become the order of the day, if free flow of information and ideas is curtailed, you're not going to have the very things that have made the United States so successful economically. But I also want to add that while I say this, you shouldn't read me as saying that, well, the United States is perfect in terms of its economy. No, there are lots of problems, and we have to also try to go back and rebuild the institutions and then much improve them in order to tackle these sort of fault lines.
Right. I mean, I almost want to have a little bit of this conversation in reverse, because if, you know, democracy is key to a functioning economy, how much are our economic problems contributing to weakening our institutions? Certainly they contribute to division.
They do, absolutely. I mean, look, Trump came to power for a variety of reasons, and there are certain things about his appeal, how he leveraged his fame and his divisive rhetoric and his ability to sort of speak to to some portion of the U.S. electorate. But the grievances he exploited and deepened were there for a long time before Trump was on the scene. If you look at the U.S. economy, in the 40 years after World War II, it is not perfect, but it is pretty good approximation of shared growth. All different groups are growing more or less at the same rate in terms of their real incomes. Employment rates are high. There are lots of good jobs around. Inequality is stable. So a rising tide is lifting most boats. But then you look at it over the last 30 years, especially over the last 20 years, it is a sea change, completely different. Real wages for many people are declining. Many groups are declining. Inequality is skyrocketing. Productivity is slow. Good jobs are nowhere to be seen. And we are not generating many jobs. And the jobs that we're generating are low-paying gig economy type jobs or personal services. So it's a very, very different picture. And that's a deep failure that has really damaged many people's confidence in both U.S. institutions and the American dream, and the backlash that sort of translated into a support for Donald Trump cannot be understood without that. It's not just that, but cannot be understood without that.
Is there a way to, I don't want to cut to the chase here, but I want to cut to the chase, right? Because we are all, one hopes, interested in rebuilding both our institutions and our economy. And what you've just laid out seems, I'm a 57-year-old man, and I'm going to say that in my lifetime, that's not going to get done.
Well, that you know, took me aback, because I thought I was being pessimistic. You are more pessimistic than me, Kai.
Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the podcast.
He has a gift, look, sir. He has a gift.
Yes, yes. Well, wonderful. No, it's a great question, actually. You know, and I don't think it's something you can do over a few years, but we can definitely turn the U.S. economy around within a decade or even less. But we need to agree what the problems are, what the root causes are, and how we can build a broad enough coalition to do it, which then brings us to these social and cultural issues as well. But I think at the root of the current malaise is that we have not produced good jobs, by which I mean high-paying, career-building, stable jobs for workers without college degrees, and even some workers with college degrees. So we have to go back to doing that. That's not something you can achieve just by waving a magic wand, but there are a number of levers that you can use and some more controversial ideas that I think we need to start discussing. It's not just about fiscal policy. It's not just about monetary policy. I think it's a broader restructuring of the economy that we need to be talking about.
I actually want to go back to basics for a second, because, you know, just this week we heard news that foreign investment in China has outpaced the U.S. for the first time. So I want to go all the way back to this question of democracy and healthy economies. Like, are we sure that democracy produces the healthiest economies?
Well, look, I think the foreign capital will go wherever, especially during these last few decades when, you know, interest rates have been so low. International capital has been in search of any place that delivers yields. So we've seen money pour into Russia, we've seen money pour into India, we've seen money pour into South Africa, Turkey, all of them with terrible political and economic problems, while foreign capital was very happy to invest in those places. Yes, I think there are fundamental issues about how China is influencing the world economic order, and it is very difficult for European countries and even, you know, US companies to have a principled position against China, because there's a lot of possibility of profits when you do business with China. So I think all of those are complicating factors. And I don't have a crystal ball and I cannot look into the future, but what I know is that if you look at the past, democracies have had a bad reputation of ineffective, gridlocked, etc. But when you look at the data, in the past, democracies have grown faster than dictatorships. They have done so by investing in exactly the things that we value. They invest in education, health, infrastructure. They actually do better things for markets than non-democracies, because non-democracies often create lots of barriers to protect their cronies. Now, would it be immediate to say that we know, therefore, that the future is going to be the same? Look, I think there are many, many wild cards out there. Perhaps with the Chinese economy is going to become so dominant and AI is going to be a new tool in the hands of many autocratic regimes and things are going to start changing. I think there are lots of interesting questions to be talking about, but I don't think that there is as yet any evidence that suggests that non-democracies are going to be better.
So, look, I'm going to say here that I'm planning on living until 95. So we've got a number of decades yet. Let me just get that out there.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that.
All right, good. I want to pick up on that thing about controversial decisions and conversations that we need to have, right? Because let's talk about solutions. As we try to repair the damage that has been done, not just in the last 4 years, but honestly in the last 40, as you said at the beginning, what are the conversations we need to be having?
Well, I think there are different conversations we need to have on politics, economics, and culture. Let me start with economics. I think, you know, fiscal policy and monetary policy, I think those are going to be the focus as we come out of the coronavirus crisis, and that's right. But with the horizon of a few years, we have to start thinking about how can we create more good jobs. And I think for that, we need to rejuvenate our technological creativity. And what that means isn't just give more leeway to Silicon Valley or every entrepreneur who comes up with a good idea. We need to have an innovation strategy. We need to have the government as part of it, because some of the new technologies, even though they appear wonderful, they're not generating great social benefits. We're not getting huge productivity gains, but what's worse, many of the companies that are leading the US technology are becoming bigger, are becoming very profitable, but they're not creating jobs. They're not creating opportunities for low education individuals. And they're putting too much emphasis on automation via robotics, algorithms, and machines. So we have to find a way of increasing human creativity. We know how to do that in broad strokes, but many people would be sort of say, oh no, you don't want to have a society in which the government plays a role in redirecting technology. Well, my answer is, well, we've always done it like that. Yeah. You know, we would not have had antibiotics and the internet and the sensors and all the nuclear technologies without the government and the climate change. Look, we're not doing great on climate change, but we would have been in a much worse position if there wasn't this amazing improvement in renewable and energy technology. And that's all because of, you know, government and society's pressure on companies to redirect their technological changes. So there's a lot to be done to re-envisage where we can go with our technology, and that would benefit Americans of all backgrounds and skills. We also have to think about how can we do this without creating greater polarization. When you sort of read, and you know, I live in Boston, you know, I don't live in the communities that have been traditionally economic losers out of these changes and that have turned to Trump. But when you read about them and you visit them, you see that there are economic grievances, but there are also cultural grievances. I'm not saying that I agree with their cultural grievances, but we have to take those into account. We have to recognize them. Just saying, no, you're not allowed to have those cultural grievances is not a solution. I think it exacerbates the problem. So we have to find some common goals to come around and find a way of minimizing our differences. And I think that's a very, very challenging thing. But the way the country has become so polarized, right, and, you know, everything happening through extreme messages from both left and right over Twitter, I think that doesn't help. So we have to find a new way of doing that. I think Biden is sort of understands that part. And that's very encouraging.
Daron Acemoglu is an economist at MIT and co-author of the book Why Nations Fail. Thank you so much for the time today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Lot to
great
tackle.
Thank you.
In Kai's remaining lifespan.
We'll try.
Let's get to work.
Well, I'm glad we have 30 years. With 20, it would have been hard. But
that's right.
30, we'll try.
30,
right,
we can totally do this. We got
take care.
This. Bye-bye. Thank you, sir. Appreciate
bye-bye
it.
Bye-bye.
Oh, man.
You know what? People like a deadline.
That's right. That's
no
right.
No pun intended.
That's right. You know. Oh, man.
That was messed up. I'm sorry. That was messed up. Yeah, I mean, a part of his research that I think is very interesting is he talks about not just strong institutions, but inclusive institutions,
yeah,
which is something we talk about on the show all the time, the idea that the more people that participate in your healthy economy, the healthier your economy is, or your healthy democracy, the healthier your economy might be.
Right, right. And that's kind of the road that Biden is kind of trying to tread right now, you know?
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a little break from the conversation and the jackhammers and all of that good stuff. Send us your comments, would you, on what Professor Acemoglu had to say. Email or voice memo. Voice memos obviously are better because nobody needs to hear me and Molly talk more. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Coming right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
And we're back. Very quick news hit, and then we're getting to some tape. We're back. Okay, you go first because mine.
We're like, get to the tape.
I'm a big fan of mine.
Get away from the jackhammers. Yeah, I I'm big on climate stuff.
Yes.
And particularly though, the kind of niche that we are trying to carve out on the Tech Show is specifically talking about adaptation. The idea of like building societies that are more resilient to the extreme weather resulting from climate change. And it's been a very small part of the climate conversation for a long time. In fact, Al Gore was famously super opposed to even talking about adaptation. It was very, and then eventually came around and said, we have to talk about both. The flip side, of course, is mitigation, where we try to slow down warming, right? Improve the overall climate. But as the effects of climate change get more severe constantly, whether it's drought or flood or fire or hurricane, the adaptation conversation is and the money behind it has gotten a lot more significant. And that's why we call our series How We Survive. And so I was happy to see that there was a piece from Monday this week saying that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, might just basically try to kind of bypass Congress and just start deploying $10 billion into adaptation and prevention, whether it's like building levees or early warning systems or new types of technology to create resilient infrastructure, make it more equitable. It is like in the scope of money that's been spent on prevention and adaptation in the past, staggering. It's a huge amount of money.
Do you remember, like, wasn't that long ago, we would do stories about adaptation and people would say, no, we must fight it. We are going to beat back climate change. And you're like, no, we're not. Look outside.
Right.
And now that's the standard course is adaptation is the way to do this because it is the way we survive, you know?
Right. And it's not, you know, nobody's saying it's the only way. And nobody is saying that we should stop our efforts at mitigation. The more we slow warming, the better better off we will be in the future. But, the fact is, it's climate change.
Right. We should start talking about it.
Climate changing. Yeah. It is an ongoing evolution, and it's really, really dangerous. There's an organization headed by Ban Ki-moon, and Bill Gates, I think, is part of it, and it's like this Global Adaptation Commission, and they estimate that if we spend, $1 trillion. On adaptation and resilience, we'll get back $7 trillion in economic benefit because we won't have so much cleanup cost. We literally won't have to spend so much recovering, and we will maintain all the economic activity that's, this is why this is becoming like a Fed story because Jerome Powell has talked about the potential need to start considering climate as a risk to global financial systems. And certainly a risk to every business on Earth. So it's just it's like a super interesting. I'm a little more obsessed than your average bear. I will admit that.
We should all get this obsessed, right? We should all get this obsessed. That's the name of that game.
It's how we survive.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So mine, it's more of a make me smile, honestly, but it hits a couple of newsy things too. And I just want to give you the details of me and web surfing late last night. Late for me, which is like 10:15. Anyway, so I'm scrolling through and I come upon this article at Complex, right? Which is kind of culture and music. It's a website that does a bunch of those stories. And it's a story about, and I don't know if you remember this during the inauguration, but there's Amy Klobuchar on the west front of the Capitol of the United States setting up the inauguration of the 46th president. And behind her coming down the stairs is some dude wearing a pair of Air Jordans, right? And of course, the internet went,
and
what
I wondered.
The heck? So there were some industrious reporters out there who tracked this person down. And this is the part that I love. So his name is Nicholas Ajago, or maybe it's Ayago. I don't know. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Anyway, he is the husband of Mina Harris, who is Vice President Harris's niece. Okay?
Right.
Mm-hmm. He used to be, it turns out, the head of global partnerships at Facebook, okay, gave up his job when Mina Harris decided that she wanted to become a children's book author. So he now takes care of their two kids who are like 5 and 2 or 5 and 3. Anyway, this is a lovely, lovely, lovely interview with him about that day, about the sneakers, which are, by the way, he says to his sneakerhead co-host on this podcast, not cheap, not cheap.
Oh, no,
cheap,
they are the
these
hotness.
Sneakers.
Yeah. Dior, they're legit.
Dior Jordan 1s, right? Do I have that right? Anyway, so I'm reading through this article, and I'm absolutely charmed. It's just lovely. It's behind the scenes, and it's just fun and conversational. It's a totally interesting guy. And then they started talking about social media and whether he's involved in it. And interestingly enough, the former head of Facebook says, not really. You know, I've got an Instagram account. I don't really do it much. I get Twitter, nah, I haven't got time for that. My wife does that. And then he says, you know, I do a little social media, but I pull myself out of it. And then he says this, and I move on to the newspaper apps and podcasts like Marketplace.
Yeah. Get right out of this town.
Yeah. I was like, that's cool. That's cool.
Wow.
I got you there. I got you there. So anyway,
that is pretty
isn't
awesome.
That great?
Did you, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but did you find out about this because you have like a Google alert set up?
I do not. No, I don't. I don't Google alert myself. I don't Google alert the show. I haven't got time for that stuff. I was legit reading it. I was like, whoa. And my wife's like,
you're
whoa.
Like, oh my God, it's
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Right.
That is amazing.
Right. Anyway, there you go.
And it's those little, are yeah. some seriously hot kicks.
Crazy. Like, yeah. So the best part is, so the interviewer says to him, so now that you've broken them out, you know, are you going to wear them now? And he says, oh, no, I'm going to take them home and wipe them off and put them back in the box. I mean, these are like four-figure sneakers, right? They're like thousands of dollars. He says, I'm going to wipe them off and put them in the box.
Yeah. They're obviously a retro, but they came out in 2020, and they retailed for $2,200 and currently resale for around
$7,000.
I'm going to guess he bought them new.
No, they were a gift, actually. They were a gift.
Oh, they were a gift?
Yeah, yeah. It's
delightful.
A great article. Super charming. Super charming.
Love it.
Anyway,
love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
All right, that is it for the news fix. Let's do the mailbag, because it's a good one today.
Yeah.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Long-time listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
How did I miss, and all these times I've heard that sting, how did I miss Ivan from Brooklyn, New York?
I don't know. He sounds like a cool dude, though.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, something a little different for the mailbag today. As we said at the top of the show, it's been 4 years since we started this podcast on Tuesdays, and we're going to do a little look back.
For our very first episode, our team went to President Trump's inauguration and to the Women's March in Los Angeles to ask voters on each side of the day what they wanted people on the other side of the political spectrum to know about them. And here's a little taste of what we got then.
For people that didn't vote for Trump, I am a patriot through and through. I grew up in the military family, and I'm as patriotic as you get, and I love everybody, no matter race, gender, ethnicity. And I just want us all to come together for our country and unify as one.
I'm really not concerned what they know about me or what they don't. they're unhappy that Trump won. I get that. I understand that. They need to just get on with their life. President Obama was president for 8 years. I didn't like it. I never missed a day of work over it. I never got in a fight over it or anything else. Went about my business. So I think they need to learn to do the same thing.
Well, about me, I guess, I don't know, I'm just a regular guy, just like everyone else that's here. But about other Trump supporters, I mean, we're all nice people. Most of us are. I mean, there are some bad people out there, but most people are good at heart, I think, and just give everyone a chance. That's all.
That we're all human, that we're not on different teams, that if they took the time to try to talk to us, that we'd be willing to talk and engage and learn from one another. We're not hostile. We don't think they're all deplorable. We're willing to bridge that gap if they are.
That I'm an American, just like them, that I have every right. I deserve respect. I deserve respect as a woman, as a minority, and as a citizen of this country.
I love America, and I, you know, for those who voted for him that are hurting economically, I feel your pain. We all want a better America. We need to do it together, not be divided.
Well, here we are, 4 years later, still working on it. Still working on it, as we have been, honestly, for hundreds of years. So
some of the same sentiments, I would imagine. Yeah.
So we went out the last couple of days and asked you, by you I mean all y'all out there, the same question. What would you like people on the other side of the political aisle to know about you? And here's some of what y'all sent in.
I guess what I want the other side to know more than anything is that even though it seemed like we were all speaking with one voice on the conservative side of things, we weren't. Not all of us drank the Kool-Aid. I spoke out against disinformation every chance that I could get over here on the right, and it's been murder. And it has cost me friends, it has cost me business, it has cost me my lawyer. So wow. Don't think that we were all in lockstep. We weren't.
Statistically, I would call myself an evangelical Christian, moderate conservative, immigrant, educator, and mom to two wonderful little girls. What I want the other side to know is that Donald Trump was absolutely bananas. His rhetoric was bananas. His policies were bananas. And I, like millions of other people like me, breathed a sigh of relief on January 20th.
I am a guy who has always been conservative. But over the last few years, I have found myself becoming more and more socially liberal. I want both sides to know I am tired of being played. While I get there are things on which the Democrats and Republicans will never agree, it's time to get busy and govern. Do your jobs. Work together for the good of all of us.
As a woman, as a longtime Democrat, I value our institutions. I value our Constitution. I believe in a democracy, and I believe in equal rights for everyone. I am not a socialist. I am not trying to take away capitalism. I am not a radical.
The thing I wish the other side knew about me is that I am a Christian, deeply, passionately, some might say evangelically. The primary driver in all my decisions is what I think God wants for me or is calling me to. I am saddened by the way that some people's version of Christianity is used to hurt and oppress people. And I often wonder if those people are reading the same Bible that I am.
What I would want Republicans to understand most about me is that when I offer a critique of American policies or want to discuss a dark time in American history, it is because I love our country, not because I hate it. If we don't hold up the mirror, how can we learn? How can we become that more perfect union? We can't gloss over the past and only choose to remember the times we are proud of.
Wow, that was great. That was Pete from Southern California. We also heard Lisa in Texas, Chris, Alan, and Wade, all from Georgia, and Gabby from Sacramento.
More perfect.
I mean, yeah. I feel better about all of us when I hear all of you.
It's a work in progress. We've got that whole episode one, by the way, of Make Me Smart. We're going to have it in the show notes. And we will end, as we always do, with the Make Me Smart question. Once again, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about?
This week's answer comes from listener Joe here in California.
I thought I knew that I didn't need poetry in my life. That changed after watching Amanda Gorman's recitation of her poem, The Hill We Climb, at the inauguration. I teared up when I watched it live, but when I read the entire text afterwards, I found myself bawling uncontrollably like I hadn't since I was a little kid. My tears were of wonder as I marveled at the wisdom of a skinny black girl 33 years my junior, and her ability to perfectly express a composition so profound that it filled my heart. My tears were of sadness of how our nation got to where we are. But the biggest tears followed with the realization that 70 million people think the last 5 years were the right way to go about living. And these tears are the hardest to keep in because I'm related to some of them and consider others to be dear friends for the roles they've played in my life. It's truly heartbreaking to watch people who have exhibited love and kindness to me over the years choose to support someone or something that is so void of the character traits that originally drew me into friendship. Amanda Gorman's words moved me like none other. Her message of hope, where we are, and what we need to continue to strive for will resonate with me for the rest of my life, and for that, I'm beyond thankful.
Thanks for sharing, Joe. Obviously, yeah. I teared up too. Amanda Gorman. I think you can all assume that's totally happening. Amanda Gorman, I mean, this is what a great producing staff we have on this team, has actually answered the Make Me Smart question before. We're not going to run it today because we had a pretty beefy show, but I want you to know that you can find it on the website, marketplace.org. We tweeted it a bunch right after the inauguration because we were so proud. And I mean, I think we can all agree, like, I thought the same thing. I was like, here comes the poem. Yeah, and I mean, I say that, you know, like, I'm a writer. I should have really been, but and then it blew me away like it did everyone else. It just, it was phenomenal. So go listen to that. She's great.
Go listen to that. And as you do it, we're going to say our goodbyes. We're done for today. Questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? Come to us at our email address, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Voice memos are best. Yeah, I could go listen to that poem again, actually. I mean, in all honesty.
I think I might, you know, I woke up a little bummed about everybody not getting along, if I'm being honest, and what it's going to take to get us there. And Amanda Gorman is just what I need today. You're right. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ben Hethcote produces video. And Erica Phillips writes our newsletter, Smart Speaker Skills, and occasionally real-time buzzkills.
Ben Tolliday engineered today. Drew Jostad's going to mix it later on. Our theme music, Ben did that with Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And there we go.
Through rain and shine and leaf blowers and mowers and jackhammers.
That's right.
We're here for you, friends.
Shall not stay us from our appointed rounds.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.